Our reading this morning is from Exodus chapter 3, verses 1 to 15. Moses and the burning bush. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I'll go over and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, here I am. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. Then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. The Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And God said, I will be with you, and this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me. And they ask me, what is his name? Then what shall I tell them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. That is what you say to the Israelites. I am has sent me. God also said to Moses, say to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, the name you shall call me from generation to generation.
Yeah, the second reading will be coming from the book of Matthew, chapter 16, 21 to 28. I read, from that time forth began Jesus to show unto his disciples how that he must go unto Jerusalem and suffer many things of the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised again the third day. Then Peter took him and began to rebuke him, saying, be it far from thee, Lord, this shall not be unto thee. But he turned and said unto Peter, get thee behind me, Satan, thou art an offense unto me, for thou sufferest not the things that be of God, but those that be of men. Then said Jesus unto the disciples, if any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whosoever will suffer his life shall lose it. Whosoever will save his life shall lose it, and whosoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it. 26. For what is a man profited if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Of what shall a man give in exchange for his own soul? For the Son of Man shall come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and then he shall reward every man according to his works. 28 the last. Verily I say unto you, there be some standing here which shall not taste of death till they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom.
I should perhaps just warn you that, very pleased though I am to be here this morning with you, I've had a rather nasty cough all week, and it may break out on me. I'm not infectious, but please bear with me if that does happen. But hopefully, please God, it won't. So, now, one of the lighter sides of being a teacher, as others of you here may recognise, is the occasional involuntary humour that you get in the written work that's handed to you for marking. I'm sure you know the kind of thing I mean, the misspelling or the wrong word that completely changes the meaning of the sentence, or the poorly explained idea that comes over as unintentionally comic. Now, I don't want to make anyone feel uncomfortable by talking about this, but in the light of the Old Testament reading we've just heard, I can't resist sharing with you a sentence that I came across once in a piece of work that I was marking. Now, the sentence was obviously referring to the same incident from Exodus that we heard about in the reading, but it took quite a distinctive view of the whole business, because it declared, when Moses was in the desert, he saw a burning bust. Now, I have to say, if that really was what Moses saw, I'm not surprised he did a double take. Joking apart, though, if I can fix the audio, the speaker. Joking apart, though, the story of Moses and the burning bush is one of the best known episodes from the Old Testament. It describes how God, and I quote, comes down into the bush, and from it attracts Moses' attention so that Moses can be commissioned to carry out God's purpose, namely, to save the Israelites, to whom God has been committed since before they were even a people. To save these Israelites from hardship and sorrow and slavery in Egypt. Moses himself, though, isn't too keen on the idea. Not least because Egypt is somewhere that he has recently escaped from in fear for his own life. And he has no particular desire to go back there and give them another shot at him. The chapter we read from and the following one, chapter 4, are therefore an account of how God works on Moses to persuade him, while Moses throws up all sorts of objections. Who am I to do this? Who are you to ask me to do this? What if the Israelites don't listen? What if Pharaoh doesn't listen? What if I get tongue-tied? I never was very good at this public speaking lot. Can't you just send someone else? In the end, as we know, God says, oh, for goodness sake, get on with it and do it. I'm right there with you, so there's no need for all this argy-bargy. And faced with that ultimatum, Moses has nowhere else to hide. So he gets on and does it, with all the ups and downs it involves, laughing, crying, raging, despairing, rejoicing, in equal measure, until the Israelites have been brought out of slavery in Egypt and across the desert to the threshold of their new life. And guess what? God is right there with him and the people every step of the way, encouraging, chastising, providing, guiding, strengthening, enabling, and revealing. Revealing more to the people and to Moses about themselves and about God's own self, as together they stagger through the trials and temptations, the joys and the sorrows of a life on the move. But in our reading from today, all that is still in the future. We're just at the stage of introductions. And for a supposed member of the people of Israel, Moses seems surprisingly ignorant about the God who has accosted him so unexpectedly in the burning bush. He recognizes the presence of a deity, certainly. After all, what else can it be when a flaming bush starts talking to you? And he listens politely enough when God outlines his mission, though he does seem to think that it's all up to him rather than to God when he says, "Who am I to go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?" To which God replies, "I will be with you, dummy." But Moses isn't reassured, and so we have this remarkable exchange in which Moses asks God, "And who are you exactly?" Look how he phrases the question. "Okay, suppose I go to the children of Israel and I say to them, 'The God of your fathers,'" note the "your fathers," not "our fathers," "'the God of your fathers has sent me to you.'" And they say to me, "Yeah, what's his name?" What will I say to them? At this point, Moses seems to know neither who God is nor who he himself is. Moses, as we know from the backstory in Exodus 1 and 2, is a Hebrew, a member of the children of Israel. But he has been brought up as a foundling in Pharaoh's palace by Pharaoh's daughter. So to all intents and purposes, he has become an Egyptian. But he got himself into Pharaoh's bad books by killing an Egyptian soldier who was harassing a Hebrew slave. And he had to flee to the country, to the neighbouring area of Midian, where, still identified as an Egyptian, he has been welcomed by and married the daughter of a Midianite priest. So he spent the last however many years as an Egyptian Midianite, or a Midianite Egyptian, looking after his father-in-law's sheep, which seems to suit him quite nicely. Does he really not know that he's a Hebrew? Or is his Hebrew heritage just an inconvenient fact that he's refusing to acknowledge? After all, every other Hebrew that he knows about is in slavery in Egypt. And if he admits to being one of them, it could really upset the apple cart for him, especially if this flaming deity is now on at him to go back to Egypt. So we see Moses distancing himself from this God and from the people about whom the God claims to care. Even though God's self-introduction to Moses at the start of the burning bush encounter is, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." In other words, "I am your God too, if you would only care to acknowledge it." But no, Moses doesn't care to acknowledge it. He's happy where he is, thank you very much. And he's married to the daughter of a holy man, so his religious needs are catered for. Thank you very much again. So when he rather sceptically imagines himself going to the children of Israel and giving them the message from this brazen, blazing deity, he refuses to identify with them. Instead, he pictures himself saying to them, "The God of your fathers has sent me." As if he, Moses, is nothing to do with them, just some convenient lackey who's been pigeonholed by the God in question. but doesn't really want to get involved. For Moses, there's just too much at stake. But not only does Moses seem ignorant or in denial about his own identity, he seems equally so about God's identity. The question about what he should say to the Israelites who ask him the name of this God puts the query in their mouths, but it's really Moses' own query. Who are you, God? And here we get the well-known answer that's not really an answer, but an invitation. I am who I am, or I will be who I will be. Both translations of the Hebrew are acceptable, and if you think they're both equally cryptic, you'd be right. The point seems to be that this God isn't going to be boxed into self-definition by a name. You know how it is when you get names for things. It gives them substance and reality. But it can also limit them, because names generate expectations and create boundaries. Names tell us that something or someone is this and not that. And as such, that can give us a sense of power or control over the thing or person that is named. Calling someone or something a particular name in a very real sense makes them into whatever it is they have been called, for better or for worse. But the God who talks to Moses refuses to be pinned down with a name and says instead, I will be who or what I will be. In other words, if you really want to know who I am, come along with me and find out. I'm not going to give you limited or misguided expectations of me by telling you a name and having you think that's all there is to it. And yet, despite initially refusing to give Moses a name, God does go on to do so in a way that speaks of God's long-term commitment to the people to whom Moses is being sent. Say to the children of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is how I am to be remembered down the generations, says God. The point here is that the name translated for us as the Lord is, in its Hebrew form, Yahweh, either a part of or derived from a part of the Hebrew verb to be. So as well as hinting at God's freedom to be whatever God will be in the future, this title, Yahweh, the God of your fathers, of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, also stresses God's faithfulness and long-term commitment to the people through past generations. This means that we get a picture of a God whom past events have shown and previous generations have experienced to be faithful and trustworthy. But a God who isn't limited by or to those past events for the future. I will be what I will be, remember? And the only way truly to discover what that will be is to accept the invitation to go along with God, wherever the journey may take us. Now at this point, let's turn to the reading we heard from Matthew's Gospel, in which Peter is, and Jesus and the other disciples are talking about Jesus' identity. In the passage that comes just before this one, which you may be familiar with, Jesus asks the disciples who they think he is, and Peter tells him, you are the Christ, or the Messiah, the Anointed One, the Son of the Living God. And Jesus praises Peter for his insight. That was before what we read. But in our reading, something else happens, which reminds us of how names and titles determine and indeed limit our expectations. Jesus starts to tell his disciples how he, the Messiah, the Christ, the Son of the living God, will go to Jerusalem and suffer and be killed and then rise again. But Peter doesn't like this and tries to stop him saying such things. "This will never happen to you, Lord," he says. And how does Jesus respond? "Back off, you Satan. You're a snare to me, because you're not thinking in a godly way, but in an earthly way." It seems that identifying Jesus as the Christ has determined for Peter what should and should not happen to Jesus. And it's inconceivable to Peter that the Son of the living God should be treated in the appalling fashion that Jesus is describing. And yet, from our perspective, we see that it is precisely what it meant for Jesus to be the Son of the living God. Just as God invites Moses onto a journey of discovery by telling him, "I will be what I will be," Jesus invites the disciples onto a journey of discovery by telling them that the Christ they follow will be crucified and rise again. But the discovery in these journeys isn't only about God. It's a journey of self-discovery too. Moses will have to forfeit his quiet life as a shepherd, but he will be enabled to recognize and embrace his Hebrew self and to rise to the challenges of leading God's rebellious people as he strives to follow where "I am" takes him. Jesus' disciples, both then and now, must similarly be prepared to forfeit what they were or what they thought they were in order to become more truly who they are in relationship with him. Jesus expresses it as denying oneself, taking up one's cross, and following him. And in his words, there is the clear warning to expect difficulties and hardships of various kinds. But just as Moses is not called to go it alone, nor are Jesus' disciples. Indeed, the challenge in each case is the same. For Moses, for the disciples, for us. Come along for the journey in reliance on divine power. It may well be hard and will involve a complete revolution of mindset. But in the process, you will learn more about God and about yourself than you thought possible. And you will be enabled to do God's will as you become the person God intends you to be.